Dagny, why is it that most women would never admit that? But you do. Because they're never sure that they ought to be wanted. I am. I do admire self-confidence. Self-confidence was only one part of what I said, Hank. What's the whole? Confidence of my value and yours. He glanced at her as if catching the spark of a sudden thought, and she laughed, adding, I wouldn't be sure of holding a man like Orrin Boyle, for instance. He wouldn't want me at all. You would. Are you saying, he asked slowly, that I rose in your estimation when you found that I wanted you? Of course. That's not the reaction of most people of being wanted. It isn't. Most people feel that they rise in their own eyes if others want them. I feel that others live up to me if they want me. And that is the way you feel too, Hank, about yourself, whether you admit it or not. That's not what I said to you then on that first morning, he thought, looking down at her. She lay stretched out lazily, her face blank, but her eyes bright with amusement. He knew that she was thinking of it, and that she knew he was. He smiled, but said nothing else. As he sat half-stretched on the couch, watching her across the room, he felt at peace, as if some temporary wall had risen between him and the things he had felt on his way here. He told her about his encounter with the man from the State Science Institute, because even though he knew that the event held danger, an odd, glowing sense of satisfaction still remained from it in his mind. He chuckled at her look of indignation. Don't bother being angry at them, he said. It's no worse than all the rest of what they're doing every day. Hank, do you want me to speak to Dr. Stadler about it? Certainly not. He ought to stop it. He could at least do that much. I'd rather go to jail. Dr. Stadler? You're not having anything to do with him, are you? I saw him a few days ago. Why? In regard to the motor? The motor. He said it slowly, in a strange way, as if the thought of the motor had suddenly brought back to him a reality he had forgotten. Dagny? The man who invented that motor. He did exist, didn't he? Why? Of course. What do you mean? I mean only that it's a pleasant thought, isn't it? Even if he's dead now. He was alive once. So alive that he designed that motor. What's the matter, Hank? Nothing. Tell me about the motor. She told him about her meeting with Dr. Stadler. She got up and paced the room while speaking. She could not lie still. She always felt a surge of hope and of eagerness for action when she dealt with the subject of the motor. The first thing he noticed were the lights of the city beyond the window. He felt as if they were being turned on one by one, forming the great skyline he loved. He felt it, even though he knew that the lights had been there all the time. Then he understood that the thing which was returning was within him. The shape coming back drop by drop was his love for the city. Then he knew that it had come back because he was looking at the city, past the taut, slender figure of a woman whose head was lifted eagerly, as at a sight of distance, whose steps were a restless substitute for flight. He was looking at her as at a stranger. He was barely aware that she was a woman, but the sight was flowing into a feeling, the words for which were, "This is the world and the core of it. This is what made the city." They go together. The angular shapes of the buildings and the angular lines of a face stripped of everything but purpose, the rising steps of steel, and the steps of a being intent upon his goal. This is what they had been. All the men who had lived to invent the lights, the steel, the furnaces, the motors, they were the world, they, not the men who crouched in dark corners, half begging, half threatening, boastfully, displaying their open sores as their only claim on life and virtue. So long as he knew that there existed one man with the bright courage of a new thought, could he give up the world to those others? So long as he could find a single sight to give him a life-restoring shot of admiration, could he believe that the world belonged to the sores, the moans, and the guns? The men who invented motors did exist. He would never doubt their reality. It was his vision of them that had made the contrast unbearable, so that even the loathing was the tribute of his loyalty to them, and to that world which was theirs and his. Darling, he said. Darling, like a man awakening suddenly, when he noticed that she had stopped speaking. What's the matter, Hank? She asked softly. Nothing. Except that you shouldn't have called Stadler. His face was bright with confidence. His voice sounded amused, protective, and gentle. She could discover nothing else. He looked as he had always looked. It was only the note of gentleness that seemed strange and new. I kept feeling that I shouldn't have, she said. But I didn't know why. I'll tell you why. He leaned forward. What he wanted from you was a recognition that he was still the Dr. Robert Stadler he should have been, but wasn't, and knew he wasn't. He wanted you to grant him your respect, in spite of, and in contradiction to his actions. He wanted you to juggle reality for him, so that his greatness would remain, but the State Science Institute would be wiped out, as if it had never existed. And you're the only one who could do it for him. Why I? Because you're the victim. She looked at him, startled. He spoke intently. He felt a sudden violent clarity of perception, as if a surge of energy were rushing into the activity of sight, fusing the half-seen and half-grasped into a single shape and direction. Dagny, they're doing something that we've never understood. They know something which we don't, but should discover. I can't see it fully yet, but I'm beginning to see parts of it. That looter from the State Science Institute was scared when I refused to help him pretend that he was just an honest buyer of my metal. He was scared, way deep. Of what? I don't know. Public opinion was just his name for it, but it's not the full name. Why should he have been scared? He has the guns, the jails, the laws. He could have seized the whole of my mills if he wished, and nobody would have risen to defend me, and he knew it. So why should he have cared what I thought? But he did. It was I who had to tell him that he wasn't a looter, but my customer and friend. That's what he needed from me, and that's what Dr. Stadler needed from you. It was you who had to act as if he were a great man who had never tried to destroy your rail and my metal. I don't know what it is that they think they accomplish, but they want us to pretend that we see the world as they pretend they see it. They need some sort of sanction from us. I don't know the nature of that sanction, but, Dagny, I know that if we value our lives, we must not give it to them. If they put you on a torture rack, don't give it to them. Let them destroy your railroad and my mills, but don't give it to them. Because I know this much. I know that that's our only chance. She had remained standing still before him, looking attentively at the faint outline of some shape she too had tried to grasp. Yes, she said. Yes, I know what you've seen in them. I felt it, too. But it's only like something brushing past that's gone before I know I've seen it, like a touch of cold air. And what's left is always the feeling that I should have stopped it. I know that you're right. I can't understand their game, but this much is right. We must not see the world as they want us to see it. It's some sort of fraud, very ancient and very vast. And the key to break it is to check every premise they teach us, to question every precept, to... She whirled to him at a sudden thought, but she cut the motion and the words in the same instant. The next words would have been the ones she did not want to say to him. She stood looking at him with a slow, bright smile of curiosity. Somewhere within him he knew the thought she would not name, but he knew it only in that prenatal shape which has to find its words in the future. He did not pause to grasp it now, because in the flooding brightness of what he felt, another thought, which was its predecessor, had become clear to him and had been holding him for many minutes past. He rose, approached her, and took her in his arms. He held the length of her body pressed to his, as if their bodies were two currents rising upward together, each to a single point, each carrying the whole of their consciousness to the meeting of their lips. What she felt in that moment contained, as one nameless part of it, the knowledge of the beauty in the posture of his body as he held her, as they stood in the middle of a room high above the lights of the city. What he knew, what he had discovered tonight, was that his recaptured love of existence had not been given back to him by the return of his desire for her, but that the desire had returned after he had regained his world, the love, the value, and the sense of his world. and that the desire was not an answer to her body, but a celebration of himself and of his will to live. He did not know it, he did not think of it, he was past the need of words. But in the moment when he felt the response of her body to his, he felt also the unadmitted knowledge that that which he had called her depravity was her highest virtue. This capacity of hers to feel the joy of being as he felt it. Chapter 2. The Aristocracy of Pull. The calendar in the sky beyond the window of her office said September 2nd. Dagny leaned wearily across her desk. The first light to snap on at the approach of dusk was always the ray that hit the calendar. When the white glowing page appeared above the roofs, it blurred the city, hastening the darkness. She had looked at that distant page every evening of the months behind her. "Your days are numbered," it had seemed to say, as if it were marking a progression toward something it knew but she didn't. Once it had clocked her race to build the John Galt line. Now it was clocking her race against an unknown destroyer. One by one, the men who had built new towns in Colorado had departed into some silent unknown from which no voice or person had yet returned. The towns they had left were dying. Some of the factories they built had remained ownerless and locked. Others had been seized by the local authorities. The machines in both stood still. She had felt as if a dark map of Colorado were spread before her like a traffic control panel, with a few lights scattered through its mountains. One after another, the lights had gone out. One after another, the men had vanished. There had been a pattern about it, which she felt but could not define. She had become able to predict almost with certainty who would go next and when. She was unable to grasp the why. Of the men who had once greeted her descent from the cab of an engine on the platform of Wyatt Junction, only Ted Nielsen was left, still running the plant of Nielsen Motors. "Ted, you won't be the next one to go?" she had asked him on his recent visit to New York. She had asked it, trying to smile. He had answered grimly, "I hope not." "What do you mean you hope? Aren't you sure?" he had said slowly, heavily. "Dagny, I've always thought that I'd rather die than stop working, and so did the men who are gone. It seems impossible to me that I could ever want to quit, but a year ago it seemed impossible that they ever could. Those men were my friends. They knew what their going would do to us, the survivors. They would not have gone like that without a word, leaving to us the added terror of the inexplicable, unless they had some reason of supreme importance. A month ago, Roger Marsh of Marsh Electric told me he'd have himself chained to his desk, so that he wouldn't be able to leave it, no matter what ghastly temptation struck him. He was furious with anger at the men who'd left. He swore to me that he'd never do it. And if it's something that I can't resist, he said, I swear that I'll keep enough of my mind to leave you a letter and give you some hint of what it is so that you won't have to rack your brain in the kind of dread we're both feeling now. That's what he swore. 2 weeks ago he went. He left me no letter. Dagny, I can't tell what I'll do when I see it. Whatever it was that they saw when they went. It seemed to her that some destroyer was moving soundlessly through the country, and the lights were dying at his touch. Someone, she thought bitterly, who had reversed the principle of the 20th century motor, and was now turning kinetic energy into static. That was the enemy, she thought, as she sat at her desk in the gathering twilight, with whom she was running a race. The monthly report from Quentin Daniels lay on her desk. She could not be certain as yet that Daniels would solve the secret of the motor, but the destroyer, she thought, was moving swiftly, surely, at an ever-accelerating tempo. She wondered whether, by the time she rebuilt the motor, there would be any world left to use it. She had liked Quentin Daniels from the moment he entered her office on their first interview. He was a lanky man in his early 30s, with a homely, angular face and an attractive smile. A hint of the smile remained in his features at all times, particularly when he listened. It was a look of good-natured amusement, as if he were swiftly and patiently discarding the irrelevant in the words he heard, and going straight to the point a moment ahead of the speaker. "Why did you refuse to work for Dr. Stadler?" she asked. The hint of his smile grew harder and more stressed. This was as near as he came to showing an emotion. The emotion was anger. But he answered in his even, unhurried drawl. "You know, Dr. Stadler once said that the first word of free scientific inquiry was redundant. He seems to have forgotten it. Well, I'll just say that governmental scientific inquiry is a contradiction in terms." She asked him what position he held at the Utah Institute of Technology. "Night watchman," he answered.
"What?"
she gasped. "Night watchman," he repeated politely, as if she had not caught the words, as if there were no cause for astonishment. Under her questioning, he explained that he did not like any of the scientific foundations left in existence, that he would have liked a job in the research laboratory of some big industrial concern. But which one of them can afford to undertake any long-range work nowadays? And why should they? So when the Utah Institute of Technology was closed for lack of funds, he had remained there as night watchman and sole inhabitant of the place. The salary was sufficient to pay for his needs, and the Institute's laboratory was there, intact, for his own private, undisturbed use.
"So you're doing research work of your own?"
"That's right.
For what purpose?"
"For my own pleasure." "What do you intend to do if you discover something of scientific importance or commercial value? Do you intend to put it to some public use?" "I don't know." "I don't think so. Haven't you any desire to be of service to humanity?" "I don't talk that kind of language, Miss Taggart." "I don't think you do either." She laughed. "I think we'll get along together, you and I."
"We will."
When she had told him the story of the motor, when he had studied the manuscript, he made no comment, but merely said that he would take the job on any terms she named. She asked him to choose his own terms. She protested in astonishment against the low monthly salary he quoted. "Miss Taggart," he said, "if there's something that I won't take, it's something for nothing. I don't know how long you might have to pay me, or whether you'll get anything at all in return. I'll gamble on my own mind. I won't let anybody else do it. I don't collect for an intention, but I sure do intend to collect for goods delivered. If I succeed, that's when I'll skin you alive, because what I want then is a percentage, and it's going to be high, but it's going to be worth your while." When he named the percentage he wanted, she laughed. "That is skinning me alive. And it will be worth my while. Okay." They agreed that it was to be her private project and that he was to be her private employee. Neither of them wanted to have to deal with the interference of the Taggart Research Department. He asked to remain in Utah, in his post of watchman, where he had all the laboratory equipment and all the privacy he needed. The project was to remain confidential between them until and unless he succeeded. "Miss Taggart," he said in conclusion, "I don't know how many years it will take me to solve this, if ever. But I know that if I spend the rest of my life on it and succeed, I will die satisfied." He added, "There's only one thing that I want more than to solve it. It's to meet the man who has." Once a month since his return to Utah, she had sent him a check, and he had sent her a report on his work. It was too early to hope, but his reports were the only bright points in the stagnant fog of her days in the office. She raised her head as she finished reading his pages. The calendar in the distance said September 2nd. The lights of the city had grown beneath it, spreading and glittering. She thought of Reardon. She wished he were in the city. She wished she would see him tonight. Then, noticing the date, she remembered suddenly that she had to rush home to dress, because she had to attend Jim's wedding tonight. She had not seen Jim outside the office for over a year. She had not met his fiancée, but she had read enough about the engagement in the newspapers. She rose from her desk in wearily distasteful resignation. It seemed easier to attend the wedding than to bother explaining her absence afterwards. She was hurrying across the concourse of the terminal when she heard a voice calling, "Miss Taggart," with a strange note of urgency and reluctance together. It stopped her abruptly. She took a few seconds to realize that it was the old man at the cigar stand who had called. "I've been waiting to catch sight of you for days, Miss Taggart. I've been extremely anxious to speak to you." There was an odd expression on his face, the look of an effort not to look frightened.
"I'm sorry," she said, smiling. "I've been rushing in and out of the building all week and didn't have time to stop."
He did not smile. "Miss Taggart, that cigarette with the dollar sign that you gave me some months ago, where did you get it?"
She stood still for a moment.
"I'm afraid that's a long, complicated story," she answered. "Have you any way of getting in touch with the person who gave it to you?"
"I suppose so.
Though I'm not too sure. Why?"
"Would he tell you where he got it?"
"I don't know."
"What makes you suspect that he wouldn't?"
He hesitated, then asked, "Miss Taggart, what do you do when you have to tell someone something which you know to be impossible?"
She chuckled.
"The man who gave me the cigarette said that in such a case, one must check one's premises."
"He did? About the cigarette?"
"Well, no, not exactly. But why?
What is it you have to tell me?"
"Miss Taggart, I've inquired all over the world. I've checked every source of information in and about the tobacco industry. I have had that cigarette stub put through a chemical analysis. There is no plant that manufactures that kind of paper. The flavoring elements in that tobacco have never been used in any smoking mixture I could find. That cigarette was machine-made, but it was not made in any factory I know. And I know them all. Miss Taggart, to the best of my knowledge, that cigarette was not made anywhere on earth."
Reardon stood by watching absently while the waiter wheeled the dinner table out of his hotel room. Ken Daniger had left. The room was half dark. By an unspoken agreement, they had kept the lights low during their dinner so that Daniger's face would not be noticed and perhaps recognized by the waiters. They had had to meet furtively, like criminals who could not be seen together. They could not meet in their offices or in their homes, only in the crowded anonymity of a city, in his suite at the Wayne Falkland Hotel. There could be a fine of $10,000 and 10 years of imprisonment for each of them if it became known that he had agreed to deliver to Daniger 4,000 tons of structural shapes of Reardon metal. They had not discussed that law at their dinner together, or their motives, or the risk they were taking. They had merely talked business, speaking clearly and dryly, as he always spoke at any conference. Daniger had explained that half of his original order would be sufficient to brace such tunnels as would cave in, if he delayed the bracing much longer, and to recondition the mines of the Confederated Coal Company, gone bankrupt, which he had purchased 3 weeks ago.
"It's an excellent property, but in rotten condition. They had a nasty accident there last month, cave-in and gas explosion, 40 men killed."
He had added, in the monotone of reciting some impersonal statistical report, "The newspapers are yelling that coal is now the most crucial commodity in the country. They are also yelling that the coal operators are profiteering in the oil shortage. One gang in Washington is yelling that I'm expanding too much and something should be done to stop me because I am becoming a monopoly. Another gang in Washington is yelling that I'm not expanding enough and something should be done to let the government seize my mines because I'm greedy for profits and unwilling to satisfy the public's need of fuel. At my present rate of profit, this Confederated coal property will bring back the money I spent on it in 47 years. I have no children. I bought it because there's one customer I don't dare leave without coal, and that's Taggart Transcontinental. I keep thinking of what would happen if the railroads collapsed."
He had stopped, then added,
"I don't know why I still care about that, but I do. Those people in Washington don't seem to have a clear picture of what that would be like. I have."
Reardon had said, "I'll deliver the metal. When you need the other half of your order, let me know. I'll deliver that, too." At the end of the dinner, Daniger had said in the same precise, impassive tone, the tone of a man who knows the exact meaning of his words, "If any employee of yours or mine discovers this and attempts private blackmail, I will pay it within reason, but I will not pay if he has friends in Washington. If any of those come around, then I go to jail."
"Then we go together," Reardon had said.
Standing alone in his half-darkened room, Reardon noted that the prospect of going to jail left him blankly indifferent. He remembered the time when, aged 14, faint with hunger, he would not steal fruit from a sidewalk stand. Now the possibility of being sent to jail, if this dinner was a felony, meant no more to him than the possibility of being run over by a truck, an ugly physical accident without any moral significance. He thought that he had been made to hide, as a guilty secret,
the only business transaction he had enjoyed in a year's work, and that he was hiding as a guilty secret his nights with Dagny, the only hours that kept him alive. He felt that there was some connection between the two secrets, some essential connection which he had to discover. He could not grasp it. He could not find the words to name it. But he felt that the day when he would find them, he would answer every question of his life. He stood against the wall, his head thrown back, his eyes closed, and thought of Dagny. And then he felt that no questions could matter to him any longer. He thought that he would see her tonight, almost hating it, because tomorrow morning seemed so close, and then he would have to leave her. He wondered whether he could remain in town tomorrow, or whether he should leave now without seeing her, so that he could wait, so that he could always have it ahead of him, the moment of closing his hands over her shoulders and looking down at her face. "You're going insane," he thought. But he knew that if she were beside him through every hour of his days, it would still be the same. He would never have enough of it. He would have to invent some senseless form of torture for himself in order to bear it. He knew he would see her tonight, and the thought of leaving without it made the pleasure greater. A moment's torture, to underscore his certainty of the hours ahead. He would leave the light on in her living room, he thought, and hold her across the bed, and see nothing but the curve of the strip of light running from her waist to her ankle, a single line drawing the whole shape of her long, slim body in the darkness. Then he would pull her head into the light to see her face, to see it falling back unresisting, her hair over his arm, her eyes closed, the face drawn as in a look of pain, her mouth open to him. He stood at the wall waiting, to let all the events of the day drop away from him, to feel free, to know that the next span of time was his. When the door of his room flew open without warning, he did not quite hear or believe it at first. He saw the silhouette of a woman, then of a bellboy who put down a suitcase and vanished. The voice he heard was Lillian's. "Why, Henry, all alone and in the dark?" She pressed a light switch by the door. She stood there fastidiously groomed, wearing a pale beige traveling suit that looked as if she had traveled under glass. She was smiling and pulling her gloves off with the air of having reached home. "Are you in for the evening, dear?" she asked. "Or were you going out?" He did not know how long a time passed before he answered, "What are you doing here?" "Why, don't you remember that Jim Taggart invited us to his wedding? It's tonight." "I didn't intend to go to his wedding." "Oh, but I did." "Why didn't you tell me this morning before I left?" "To surprise you, darling," she laughed gaily. "It's practically impossible to drag you to any social function, but I thought you might do it like this on the spur of the moment, just to go out and have a good time as married couples are supposed to. I thought you wouldn't mind it. You've been staying overnight in New York so often." He saw the casual glance thrown at him from under the brim of her fashionably tilted hat. He said nothing. "Of course I was running a risk," she said. "You might have been taking somebody out to dinner." He said nothing. "Or were you perhaps intending to return home tonight?"
"No."
"Did you have an engagement for this evening?"
"No."
"Fine." She pointed at her suitcase. "I brought my evening clothes. Will you bet me a corsage of orchids that I can get dressed faster than you can?" He thought that Dagny would be at her brother's wedding tonight. The evening did not matter to him any longer.
"I'll take you out if you wish," he said. "But not to that wedding."
"Oh, but that's where I want to go. It's the most preposterous event of the season, and everybody's been looking forward to it for weeks, all my friends. I wouldn't miss it for the world. There isn't any better show in town, nor better publicized. It's a perfectly ridiculous marriage, but just about what you'd expect from Jim Taggart." She was moving casually through the room, glancing around, as if getting acquainted with an unfamiliar place. "I haven't been in New York for years," she said. "Not with you, that is. Not on any formal occasion." He noticed the pause and the aimless wandering of her eyes, a glance that stopped briefly on a filled ashtray and moved on. He felt a stab of revulsion. She saw it in his face and laughed gaily. "Oh, but darling, I'm not relieved. I'm disappointed. I did hope I'd find a few cigarette butts smeared with lipstick." He gave her credit for the admission of the spying,
even if under cover of a joke. But something in the stressed frankness of her manner made him wonder whether she was joking. For the flash of an instant, he felt that she had told him the truth. He dismissed the impression because he could not conceive of it as possible.